Hey, I'm Jonathan Miller, and this is the Housing Helix Podcast. I'm a real estate appraiser, analyst, and blogger based in New York who is interested in pretty much anything related to housing with an analytical bent. The Housing Helix is the real estate conversation in long form with information, analysis, and commentary, as well as insights from housing-related experts that have something interesting to share. This episode and the entire podcast library are available as a free subscription through iTunes and at thehousinghelix.com. I hope you enjoy it. And now part two of my conversation with Barry Ritholtz.
Well, you have to put it into...
I know that's even... wildly unfair.
No, not
question,
at all. It's a great question. The issue is you can't put it into the day-to-day, week-to-week context. You have to put it into the context of consumers today are coming off of a massive credit binge.
Yes.
The credit bubble. And as the work of Reinhart and Rogoff have made very clear, following a credit binge and collapse, consumers will go through a deleveraging period
that'll
last anywhere from 5 to 10 years. So the normal recovery from a recession,
which is sort of the paradox of thrift, but it's in the sense that now they're paring back credit, they're not consuming as much.
Well, what they're doing is they're only buying what they can afford, which is a crazy idea.
It's a wild concept.
Right. Insane idea. But look, what normally happens in a regular recession, the economy is steaming along, people are getting jobs, wages are going up, everybody goes out and buys crap, and they trade up, they get a nicer car, they move up, they get a nicer house, blah, 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 everything's great. Things begin to overheat, too much money chasing too few goods and services, so the Fed goes to cool that back and raises rates a couple of times, and suddenly financing becomes pricier, credit becomes more expensive, and so home sales soften and car sales soften,
right.
And blah, 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 you have a minor recession and everything pulls back. The way the Fed fixes that is they lower rates,
right.
The cost of credit becomes cheaper, and now consumers who aren't excessively leveraged go out and home prices came down, and let's go do a little buying.
Right.
That whole moving to good hands takes place. That whole, hey, this is attractively valued, let's buy it.
But isn't this go-round different? Or not different. I don't want to say that because that's
well,
the most
but it common. Is different. It absolutely is different because it's not your typical recession recovery. It's a credit crisis recovery. So if you don't want to say this time it's different, you could say you're using the wrong data set, the post-World War II recession recoveries. That's not what this is. This
right.
is the credit crisis recoveries, of which we have Sweden and Mexico and Argentina and Japan as prior examples. Those are all decade-long recovery periods. It's, you know, a doctor can't look at everybody who comes into their office and say, we're all the same. No, this guy has the hiccups. That guy has a gunshot wound. You can say this time is different. What it normally means, what people are always afraid to say, this time is different is when things start running up in price – and instead of using the historic metrics like price-to-earnings ratio for stocks or median home price to median income for houses, hey, you don't need a 2-to-1 ratio. We'll go 5-to-1.
Right.
It's different this time because – and actually it was different because traditional lending standards went away.
Right. There was
because of the syndication process and because of the bundling
of
mortgages.
You can offload the risk to any –
right.
Anyone.
And there was a demand for it because the Fed had taken rates so low – that bonds were generating of so little yield, bond managers were scrambling. There's a rule, there's a 5% rule in foundations, trust, charities, that you have to disperse 5% of your assets each year in order to maintain a tax-exempt status. Under normal circumstances, 5% is easy. Bonds are yielding 4.5%, 5%. Stocks are yielding 8-10%. When stocks go down, bonds go up, blah, blah, blah. 5% is a no-brainer. You could usually grow your foundation and still spend 5% a year. When rates plummeted and the market crashed, suddenly there was a panic. Hey, I don't have – how the hell am I going to get to 5%? So that's what sent bond managers scrambling for a better yield. The syndicated bundled mortgages that went into CMOs,
yes,
collateralized, were yielding more than 5%. And suddenly, hey, I have the solution.
Yeah.
Here it is, your savior. And it's AAA rated.
Right.
Which nobody stopped to say, wait a second, the 10-year
is... Everything around the world, all investments like this are all AAA. There's no difference between it.
It was a free lunch. If the treasuries were yielding 3% and this AAA rated treasuries,
right.
Now AA+, but back then AAA rated treasuries were yielding 3%, and these mortgage-backed AAA were yielding 5.5%, no one said, well, that's not possible.
But why?
I said it, but most people didn't say, but that's not possible.
But right now, you know, one of the things that ails housing is you know, the mortgage underwriting. It's the tightness of credit. You know,
the pendulum has now swung to the other way.
It's overcorrected.
As always happens.
Right.
That's traditional. You swing from too loose to too tight and back.
And so I'm sort of faced with a situation where, you know, I you're watching Washington sort of beg, plead, and cajole banks that they just bailed out to lend, right?
Right.
And you know, you look at that and it's preposterous, right? They have to be economically incentivized. They have to sort of address the risk they're facing and say, hey, do I want to lend? Can I take on additional risk? Whatever. And lending, you know, mortgage lending is actually underwriting is, according to the Fed Senior Loan Officer Survey, residential mortgage lending is actually tightened.
That's
since
right.
the beginning of the year.
It's an ongoing tightening process going back to 08, 09.
Yeah.
Maybe even before that, maybe even 07.
And so to me, you know, one of the, and, you know, it's probably a cockamamie theory, but one of the things that I was sort of looking at is in many ways, and maybe it's correlation, not causation, but I feel that the Fed policy of keeping rates so low for so long.
And promising to keep them there.
And promising to keep them low is continuing to keep credit tight.
There's some of that. Look, banks are in the business of taking money and lending it out and mm-hmm. getting a profit. Now, they could lend it out to homeowners or potential homeowners, but as we've seen, that's tough business. You actually have to look at their... I know this is crazy, but you have to look at their credit history.
You got to see how much money
income,
they made.
Their other debt. At least some banks do. Others just said, the hell with it. Just fog this mirror, great. You're good. Instead, they could borrow from the Fed at zero, lend it to the Treasury at 2%,
right.
Free money.
Right.
Riskless. So the Fed, now understand what's going on. On the one hand, the Fed and the Congress can't just write checks to the banks anymore.
Right.
Here's another $1 trillion bailout. Instead, they're going to do this for a decade. That's how they're recapitalizing the banks.
Yes.
Only the people who did Paulson, Bush, and Bernanke on the first bailout were so stupid that they didn't put any terms in this.
I know.
And by the way, when they bailed out, when they nationalized Fannie and Freddie, they said, no more lobbying. Remember that?
Right, yeah.
Citi, Goldman, Morgan, they didn't put that rule into effect.
Right.
That's because, quite simply, Hank Paulson was a Goldman Sachs CEO. And basically, you know, if he was an industrialist, if he was the head of Ford instead of the head of Goldman Sachs, that rule would have been likely to be put in place.
Right.
Instead, deep down inside, he's still a banker, so he didn't want to do anything to hurt banks. That's number one. Number two, the bonuses, all the stuff that's going on. As long as these guys are sucking at the public teat, which they are with this government, with the Fed at zero, there absolutely should have been a much harsher set of rules.
So you look at that and say...
So that was a huge mistake under Bush. And the amazing thing is Obama, we now find out that the single biggest asshole in America is Larry Summers. Because Obama wanted to put Citigroup and Bank of America into nationalization, which is what the Swedes do.
Did he defy them? Obama?
Summers pretty much browbeat Obama into not doing it. So we know it's very hard to blame one person for major problems in the world, other than Hitler. I mean, you could blame Hitler and his... But now when you look at who there were so many fathers to the crisis... Clearly, Greenspan was one of the guys.
Yes.
But it turns out that Larry Summers may very well be the single biggest asshole in the United States of America. That not only did he oversee the repeal of Glass-Steagall as Treasury Secretary in the Clinton White House and oversee the Commodities Future Monetization Act, which took the entire universe of derivatives and made them hidden from federal regulators and not even state insurance regulators. It was written by, what's his name, Graham's wife, Wendy Graham, who was on the board of Enron, written for her. AIG loved it. They just piled into this, and they essentially committed suicide. Larry Summers, Treasury Secretary. If I'm Treasury Secretary, I'm telling Clinton, you got to veto this. This is a steaming pile of crap. This is going to cause major problems. So not only did Summers screw up in the 90s under Clinton, that when he went back to the White House, he wasn't done fucking the country. He gave us one last bend over and grab your ankles. The amazing thing is that Robert Rubin, here's another guy, giant asshole. Right. He's the one who gave us Geithner and Summers in yes. the Obama White House. What's fascinating is if a surgeon screws up, they figure out, hey, that guy who had the operation, there seems to be some problems and we've reviewed it and there were some mistakes made during the surgery. The same surgeon doesn't go in and fix it
right.
because he's more concerned with protecting his own ass and covering up
right.
his handiwork. So you send in a new surgeon and he will give you an honest report of what took place. Having Summers, who helped cause the screw up in the first place, and Geithner, who was head of the New York Fed
during the
overseeing all these banks, and apparently everything was fine under his watch,
right.
to put these two yahoos in place was a fatal flaw of the Obama administration. I wrote something in the 2010 elections called The Tragedy of the Obama White House, which paralleled what I had written, you know, 4 years before, the tragedy of the Bush administration, that each of these guys were given a historic opportunity to be a Reagan, to be a Churchill, right. to be an FDR, to be a Teddy Roosevelt, right. to be a Lincoln.
To mark a new era.
And they blew it. After 9/11, you know, Bush cut taxes and said, go shopping. Not exactly distinguished himself. And Obama had an opportunity after, you know, in February, March of 2009, he could have done great things. The problem was, listening to Robert Rubin, he said, who's the biggest asshole in the country? I want that guy giving me economic advice. And that's pretty much what happened. So when he becomes a one-term president because of the economy,
right.
you know, you could trace it back to Robert Rubin and giving us Larry Summers and Tim Geithner the worst. You know, and by the way, Summers is one of these guys, off the charts IQ,
yes.
really, really smart, the world's worst judgment. And you sometimes see that with people who have really, really high IQs and just zero ability to make intelligent decisions.
Can't tie their
right.
shoes.
They're right. Can't. And to look at how this guy has failed upwards
right.
to the White House twice. Right. I mean, after the situation at Harvard, this guy should be you right. know, pushing
Shouldn't
a broom.
Should have been considered.
Right. Absolutely. Just a stunt. But again, that's what happens when you take a guy who doesn't have a depth of economic background, really not very experienced. And I have to think, today we got the announcement, Chris Christie not running.
Yes.
I have to think that that had to play into his thought process. Hey, I've been governor for 2 years. I have very right. little administrative experience. We saw what the guy who similarly had
yeah.
in experience, be it Obama or Bush, two right. guys with both very, very little administrative experience, executive experience. It's caused major, major problems.
Yeah, hesitation. So let's talk about.
You can see I'm on the fence on.
No. I appreciate you coming out of your shell just yes. for this podcast. But sort of in the same line of thinking, two things. One, I want to finish up on this credit idea. Then I want to talk
sure.
about MERS.
Sure.
Okay. So real quickly, in sort of continuing what we were talking about, one of the things that I'm when I think of the bank borrowing from the Fed at zero and,
uh-huh.
and basically making a couple percentage points risk-free, you know, doing with it what they want.
Nice work if you can get it.
Yes. And the alternative is let's lend and let's make money
to qualified borrowers.
To qualified borrowers. But I view it as, well, let's try to pair the risk between the two. Let's, you know, instead of Joe and Mary homebuyer at a 4% mortgage and we're looking at possible loan mod down the road, layoffs, declining housing prices. Instead of making them AAA, I'm going to make them quadruple A because I've got to minimize the disparity between door number one and door number two. And
right.
That's my logic for
how are Mr. and Mrs. Homebuyer going to be better credit risk than Uncle
they're
Sam?
Not. They're not. So what they're doing is they're trying to get them. So that's why they're asking for, you know, 9 months of Amex statements, and they're asking for 2 years and all sorts of, you know, it's that overcorrection element.
Right.
And to me, that has much more impact on tempering transaction activity than stimulating transaction activity by dropping rates. You know, that if
right.
if you can,
the rates are no longer the problem. It's clearly
passed,
not the
we've
problem.
We've passed
and
that
hasn't.
Point, and I feel like, you know, I feel like the Fed is missing that point that low rates, at least as housing goes, are kind of done. We did have
no doubt.
We
had a 3.99 on the 30-year fixed.
It's
recently
crazy. It's
for,
crazy
for a mortgage. I mean, that's on
right.
And in I don't know about other states. In New York, we have a 0.8% mortgage recording tax, but you could get a CEMA loan, CEMA,
yes,
which allows you to consolidate, extend, modify, and if it's with the same lender, you don't have to pay the mortgage recording tax, which is
big.
Yeah, it's on a conforming mortgage. That's $5,000 or $6,000, you know, less than that. On a, let's call it, what is conforming now? 415.
Conforming in this region is 625.5.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it dropped October 1st.
From 7 and change.
729.750 to 625.5.
So let's take a $500,000 mortgage.
417 for everywhere else.
It's $4,000. It's
yeah,
a lot of money. It's the difference between, hey, does it make sense to refi or not if I don't know if I'm going to be here for 10 years?
Correct.
So yeah, there's no doubt about that. That's an ongoing problem. But look, we have an insufficiency of demand when it comes to housing. Look, I could fix housing tomorrow if you want, if you give me the authority to basically go out and say to people in...
Oh, this is your global theory,
yeah,
of pulling in immigrants
basically,
to create housing to...
come into the United States, we'll give you a green card if you buy a house, start a business, blah, blah, blah. You have to obviously pass a sort of background check. We don't want to bring a bunch of terrorists from the outskirts of Pakistan or Iran or wherever. But look, people in China, people in Eastern Europe, people in Korea, and go down the list, Vietnam, India, South America. We don't have a monopoly on smart, hardworking people. This country was built by immigrants. We have excess supply.
Yep.
You can fix that by either letting the population grow at 2% over 10 years, and we'll sop up those extra supplies with new people coming into the... Or you could bring in 2 or 3 million people over time.
Well,
and
I have to laugh at, every month we get the new construction, new home sale.
Thank goodness.
And 1 month it's up 10%, 1 month it's down 10%. But it's like 80% below peak.
Right.
So it's irrelevant.
It's such a tiny number.
And you see this
number.
Whole sort of, media frenzy if it's up a few percentage points. And it's so irrelevant, I feel.
We also
like,
did a study about 5 years ago on new home, new construction, new home sales. And a lot of that data is self-reported. And it's not that it's inaccurate over time. But I got to do that monthly thing. I'll get to it next month. So if you take the average over 2 months, you get a fairly consistent run. Anytime it's a double-digit gain or loss, it invariably mean reverts the next month, which is just showing you it's a reporting error, not actual data.
Right. Yeah, there's tremendous
fluctuation.
In the
you
reporting.
Take a two-month moving average, and it's pretty steady.
Right.
We're not building new houses. We don't need new houses anytime soon.
Right.
They're competing with foreclosures, which whack. I think the number was 30% off the selling price relative to comparables.
Right.
Which actually, people hate when I say this, but it's true. Earlier I said so much of economics takes place on the margin because typically you have a balance between buyers and sellers, supply and demand. During the boom, you essentially brought in 5 to 10 million new buyers.
Yes.
Because these were people who otherwise wouldn't have qualified for a
loan. You cast a much wider net over
so
who would qualify.
That just poured trillions of dollars into the housing market, and of course prices went through the roof.
Right.
You take away not only those marginal buyers, but the people who might have been on the edge otherwise, and now today that 10% are just not qualifying. And so not only is the boom volume gone, but the regular volume has been contracted.
Yes.
And that's how you ultimately clear out the excess prices. The foreclosures drive things down. You could tear off the Band-Aid quickly, or you could extend and pretend to do it slowly, and that's what we're doing, slowly.
Very slowly, and I think in many ways you want to incentivize investors to buy foreclosures simply because who else is going to buy them? You've got to clear the market.
You want good hands to buy them.
Good hands, right, exactly.
And instead of doing that, to me, the mortgage abatements, the mortgage mods and the foreclosure abatements, they've been a disastrous failure.
I read this. I'm going to go away from the mic. In the Harper's Index, the stat was...
more than half.
Well, the stat that they read was, it was...
It depends on if you're behind.
Here it is. Percentage of the $46 billion allocated by TARP to help homeowners refinance that has been used for that purpose, 4.3%.
Yeah, it's nothing.
It's nothing.
It's zero. A couple of billion dollars.
Effectively nothing.
But you know what? If you made a mistake and bought a house that you can't afford, it's not only in the bank's interest, it's in your interest.
Yeah, you have to move
on. Leave the house, go to a rental that's cheaper. You can, in certain neighborhoods, you can get the identical house a block over for half of what you're paying from peak prices.
Right.
There's just no reason to stay in that sort of house. I think the line of sand is 25% underwater.
Yeah.
Once the house is worth 25% less than the mortgage,
in your probable occupancy, you're not gonna be whole again. So let's talk about MERS.
Sure.
Explain what.
So MERS is this fabulous scam that was cooked up a couple of decades ago by a combination of some of the major banks, Freddie Mac, a number of other entities were involved in this.
What does MERS stand for?
Something electronic registration system, right? Mortgage
electronic.
So essentially, you know, I write it all the time, and I just
it's
on the blog. You just punch in MERS to Wikipedia, you'll get the full thing. Mortgage electronic registration, what service or whatever it is. So under a normal process. You know, we've, over the past few hundred years, developed very specific laws, rules, procedures for keeping track of who owns what. Hernando de Soto called it the mystery of capital. I've referenced his book. I've referenced his quote a number of times. And it talks about the reason capitalism thrives in the West, in places like Europe and the United States, but is a disaster in other places, is the rule of law.
I've read that article like three times. The De Soto.
The one I referenced with them. Stop and think about it. If there, and in fact, we even have a concept that if you build a fence over somebody's property line and it's there for 20 years, that property eventually becomes yours.
Right.
Like it's the laws are that.
That's why
it's got to be notorious and all.
That's why I get so crazy on that New London eminent domain case for private use instead of government use.
Right, that's absolutely unacceptable.
It was out of my mind. But anyway, I don't want to.
So what normally happens is you buy a piece of property, somebody is selling it to you. The original person who's selling it to you is the government, who under the sovereign laws, the crown was allowed to take property. All the land was the property of the crown, of the sovereign. In a democracy, all the land is stolen from the prior owners and becomes property there is a chain of title. There is a custody from seller to seller to seller, including surveys, marking out exactly where the property is, how much space is involved, what the neighbor... This is a brilliant innovation, hundreds of years old, and it very successfully made sure that everybody knew exactly who owned what.
Right. My house was built in 1825.
And you have the original survey.
I have series of transactions over time. In 1827, my house had a $100 mortgage on it.
Right.
And there's this whole progression. So I can't imagine... sort of one day waking up and there's a cloud on title.
Here's exactly what happened. Every time we mentioned the mortgage recording tax, every time every time a piece of property would change hands, and if there was a mortgage to that property, that would also have to be paid off. The new mortgage comes out, and then that's how the county collects their pound of flesh. They get their fee on that, their tax on it. And so MERS was designed to do two things, quasi-legally. Number one, this going down to the county records and actually filling out a piece of paper and filing it, it's time-consuming, it's expensive. Even though it makes sure the stuff is done precisely right, we don't have time for that.
It's old school.
It's old school, right. And number two, every time we do that, someone has to pay a transference tax. So here's the legal fiction. We'll create this entity called MERS. And they'll hold title to all these notes. They'll in theory, actually physically have the note. And so every time there's a subsequent securitization, syndication, whatever, every time the mortgage is bought and sold, rebundled, whatever, hey, we don't have to pay a fee. So it'll just, we'll still be the nominal holder of record, even though the mortgage may have changed hands 20 times.
Is that a mortgage cloud, like cloud computing?
Right, it's like, right, that's exactly right. It's a mortgage, it's a great way to describe it.
Yeah.
We don't know who literally holds it. You know, I can't tell you which
server. It's somewhere
server.
Over there.
Your Gmail, you. I can't point to which of the many servers Google has that your email is,
yeah.
But it's in the cloud. MERS and mortgages are cloud computing for, but here's the thing. As long as your Gmail shows up in your inbox, you don't care. Now, the problem is when someone goes to foreclose on a property and that mortgage has changed hands 20 times and there's no record of it, someone has to have standing to sue.
Yes.
At least in the states that require judicial foreclosures. And it turns out that not knowing who that person is,
yeah,
is really problematic. And so this has led to a number of problems. First, it turns out that in about 3 out of 4 litigations across the country, MERS loses standing to sue because they're not the named note holder.
Right.
You can't have it both ways. Either you're the nominee, either you're the representative of the bank, or you're the note holder on the other side of the table from the homeowner.
Right.
But you can't, it turns out you can't wear both those hats. It's one or the other. They want it to be a hybrid. Light, is it a particle? Is it a wave? Well, in quantum mechanics, it doesn't matter. MERS isn't quantum mechanics.
Right.
So you got to pick one, and it turns out there's disastrous consequences whichever they pick. They pick the one, they don't have standing to sue, and nobody can foreclose. If they pick the other, well, guess what? You now owe all these local villages and towns and counties.
Taxes.
All the mortgage recording fees 10, 20, 30 times on this mortgage. It's hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of dollars. Now, a year ago, I wrote something and said...
Wait, who is MERS? Who's behind?
So MERS is a collection of banks, and Fannie and Freddie put this together.
Right.
I can't tell you exactly who it was, if memory
serves.
But
it's essentially the majority of national mortgage lenders, Fannie, Freddie, and then a collection of other financial institutions.
Right.
That sort of came together.
No real employees. It's a shadow entity. It's a facade. They have,
There's not a physical operation, so to speak.
Right. It's a virtual entity. It's really very cloud computing is a great analogy. And it basically, what's really fascinating is the people who are signing on behalf of MERS are the officers and people from various banks.
I see.
And so you end up with all the, and that's how we eventually ran into the robo-signing situation down the road. But now here we have a couple of small counties suing MERS, and no one's paying attention to it. And then this month, the district attorney of Dallas, a pretty damn big city in a pretty damn big state, said, the hell with this, you sons of bitches owe us tens of millions of dollars. So I think eventually a number of other, I wrote this 6 months or a year ago, eventually, the early lucky ones will get some money, but MERS will be bankrupted because they owe, and they used to brag, we saved $8 billion in mortgage, filing fees. All these towns are in deep trouble financially, cutting back in the pullback.
They're on the hunt for revenue.
Right. They're turning over couch cushions and, oh my God, these guys owe us millions of dollars. So they'll eventually be sued out of existence. My bet is, unless there's congressional intervention, they'll go bankrupt. The fascinating question is, has the whole thing been fraudulent? Was that the intent from the get-go? And therefore, we could penetrate that fraud. It's called piercing the corporate veil.
Right.
And sue Citigroup, Bank of America, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, JP Morgan, everybody who set up this colossal legal fraud to screw the local towns to be able to do this in a way that helped create the crisis. I've made the argument, and this is a piece coming out next week, that if it wasn't for MERS, you would never have been able to have securitized as many mortgages as we did. You'd never be able to crank out as much subprime crap. I don't want to say they caused the crisis, but if it wasn't for them, it never could have gotten as bad as it did.
They primed the pump.
They absolutely primed the pump. If you want to look, I blame the rating agencies for slapping. They were the biggest whores out there. They slapped AAA stuff, AAA rating on stuff because they were paid to.
Yes.
So, to me, if you give up your virtue for money, you're a prostitute.
Right.
The rating agencies are all prostitutes. They're clearly a prime enabler. Greenspan taking rates down to such ridiculous levels, a prime enabler.
Why aren't the rating agencies getting hammered? I find that
they're just starting. It's belated. It's very belated.
You think so? Because yes. I feel like, you know, I mean, just like appraisers, my profession, were, you know, enablers during the run up. You know, when people,
not all of them.
No.
Half.
No, I'd say about 75%.
Oh, is it that much? Look, you remember a bunch of agents and appraisers went to Congress and lobbied and said, hey, these guys are crazy.
Yes.
By the way, P.S., the parallel is CEO salaries. They use the same nonsense. Hey, that guy's getting this much. Well, how do we know he's worth it? Once you're just looking at price and not actually looking at value, you end up with these ridiculous spirals.
Right.
Happened in housing. Even now, the CEO pay is just totally out of hand.
It's insane. But So that's one of the nagging questions for me is, it, like you said, maybe it's just a delay. But I do find it pretty amazing, especially after watching the last couple of years of C-SPAN testimony in Congress from the rating agencies, S&P. You know,
I take the fifth.
Yeah. So,
the S&P and by the way, I had my own pissing match. Full disclosure, Bailout Nation was supposed to originally be published by McGraw-Hill. They weren't happy with what I said about the rating agencies. And I by the way, I said no to the book 20 times. Nah, I'm not interested. Finally, I kept on giving them ridiculous demands, which they put in the contract. Normally, if a publisher wants to bury a book, they just say, well, we're going to review it further, and it goes away for two years.
Right.
And by the time you can get it back, it's over.
It's immaterial to
them. I basically had the right to buy it back by just returning the advance, which is what I did when they kept on. They pretty much said you can't say that. Well, no, they said this book is fine. We just are not happy with what you said about S&P. And I thought I was, you know, honest and accurate. And I called them bad names, so I went back and put more data, took out the bad words.
Did you use any words that you just said in the podcast?
I called them payola, and I think part of the original comment was that they so I said payola, I said prostitutes.
Right.
I said they basically sold their ratings to the highest bidder, which in this case was Merrill, Morgan, Lehman, Bear, Goldman, etc. Right. Now, their model used to be bond buyers paid for their research. That was the old model.
Yes.
In the mid-90s, they found out that the big banks had more money than the big bond buyers, so they sort of reversed, and it became underwriter-funded instead of investor-funded.
Right.
So once Morgan Stanley figured out how to game, look, if we put this many more subprimes in this, you know, they figured out how to game it exactly, they were getting AAAs every time.
Right.
And they literally shared models with the rating agency. So, would stop and think about it. Well, I'm supposed to be double checking you. If I'm using the same model, I'm going to get the same
result.
This adds up.
Right.
Just, you know, there's an old expression that, you know, you're hard pressed to get a man to understand what his job depends on him not understanding. You know, if his income is dependent on him not understanding this, hey, he's not going to understand it. That's unfortunately human nature.
We look at it from in the appraisal world, the MAI designation. No offense to one of my partners is an MAI, but the acronym in many circles stands for made as instructed.
Right. I'm always amazed how appraisals come in within, you know, a dollar of the purchase price. Barry, hey, what a coincidence.
Barry, you don't understand. We're just that good. So let's
wait. I've seen the 06-07 appraisals.
They're not.
They weren't
that good.
Oh
my god!
Look, we're down 32%. So I guess they're at more in certain areas. Obviously, South Florida and Vegas and California.
Right.
Look, I have, for the benefit of your listeners, how long have you and I been talking about buying a piece of real estate in Florida?
Right.
South Florida, intercoastal, whatever. And it's like, are we there yet?
No, not there yet.
A couple more years to go, at the least. I mean, you're starting to see some South Americans clear out
big thing.
Some of the condos.
But this is what I want to ask you about. So, and in fact, I'm putting together my third quarter Miami report. I cover the Miami market, but I cover basically the coastal communities. And one of the phenomena that's going on down there is the Brazilians and other South Americans, because the real is just the dollar is so weak against the real. Right. It's insane.
It's a currency play, not a real estate play.
Correct. But that's really helping the market.
It helped in New York. You know, there's a story about how many empty apartment buildings are there in New York where they're fully sold.
Right.
But it's all...
It's foreign buyers.
Because
they can
Germans
buy. They can bypass the credit problem because they tend to pay all cash.
Right.
But one thing that I noticed, a reporter at Bloomberg sent me a chart on the... it was the currency. It's I forget the name of the index, but it's like our six trading partners. And you can see the dollar in the month of September get a lot stronger.
Sure. And everyone forgets. You know, I keep hearing people talk about the weak dollar. The dollar fell 41% from 01 to 08. From 08 to 11, it's pretty much been range bound. And given what's going on in the euro, the dollar has been strengthening. The dollar is certainly not in free fall anymore.
Right.
But people are always out of step, behind the market.
Right. So still, like if the euro's a $1.31 against a dollar.
Down from $1.50.
Right, right. So when it starts getting in the $1.40, $1.50, you start seeing a real influx of buyers. When you're about $1.30 or so, not so much. So it's interesting because just that play in the last 30 days has really sort of offset the decline.
Right. How long does that go on for? That's really the question.
Yeah, that's the question.
Look, when the euro or the pound was $1.50 something, the manager of Toomey's, the suitcase, I don't remember if it was the Times or where I saw the interview, he was selling out because people were showing up buying empty luggage, filling it with iPods and whatever they get their hands on,
right,
and taking it back home, you know, so
50%
cheap
discount or whatever.
You know,
the real is, you know, I want to say last time I took it was like $1.80 or some insane.
Up from what? What was it a year ago?
I want to say like $1.30 or $1.40.
That's
a big move. It's a big 50%
move, sure.
But anyway, so what I want to do now is I just want to we've covered a lot of ground here, which I need you to, in the next podcast, come out of your shell more. You're kind of reserved. But
I'll drink some caffeine. It'll open me up.
But what I'd love you to do is just give another plug for your conference.
The conference, sure. Yeah. So who else is speaking at the conference? Jim Bianco, fabulous equities and bond analyst, talking about volatility and correlation in markets, why we, when things get dicey, you tend to have everything trade in lockstep. Really well-regarded institutional analyst, very, very smart guy. That's one of the
you had Henry solos. Henry
so, we have a panel looking at new media and how the impact is on investing, equities, stocks, bonds, real estate, etc. So that panel is Henry Blodgett and who else is on that panel? So there's two panels. One is he's on the venture capital panel. So it's Howard Lindzen, Henry Blodgett, James Altucher.
Wow.
Three guys who've all built businesses, sold businesses, what have you. Josh Brown, who runs the Reform Broker, he's going to moderate that panel. The other panel is the very lovely Kelly Evans of the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, sure.
And that's Joe Wiesenthal from Business Insider, Josh Brown, and Todd Harrison, and Dan Gross from Yahoo.
Yeah.
And it's all on the impact of new media on markets and equities. And then the last, there's a couple of other things throughout. We talked about Themis Trading. We talked about, there's an equity panel. Listen to this rundown. So it's Kevin Lane, John Roque, and Peter Bukvar, people who are traders and institutional buyers, three really well-known guys, a quant, a macro, and a technical guy. All three of these guys, really well-regarded market panel. And then the last thing is, last conference we did, I did a fireside chat with Doug Kass.
Wow.
And it was absolutely the most fascinating hour and a half. You know, Doug is one of these guys who doesn't answer a question. Everything is a parable. and a history lesson. You know, I'll never forget, he went into, in the last conference, he went on this discussion of why he's a bottoms-up balance sheet guy, and he tears the balance sheet apart, and, you know, he looks at all sorts of stuff, and he doesn't care about technicals, and he doesn't care about this, and he just wants to rip apart the fundamentals and find out what's going on. The very next question is, what do you think about gold? And instead of saying, schmuck, didn't you just hear what I said?
Right.
he tells this hilarious story about his mentor, who was an oil trader in the pits, and who eventually ended up owning all of these seats, and when they went public, cashed out for $1 billion.
Wow.
And his answer, I'm giving you a long story short, his answer was, so how'd you make all this money? I just know oil trading, and I have this pit. The next pit over was the S&P, and every time guys would go in, they'd blow up, and he'd buy their seat.
Right.
So after over 20, 30 years, he becomes the biggest seat holder because of the fortuity of oil being next to S&P minis on the physical floor.
Sure.
So Doug said, so $1 billion, how'd that happen? Hey, I just stick to my knitting. I'm giving you the 30-second version.
Yeah.
It was a 15-minute story. So he says to the woman, so I can't tell you about gold because I just stick to my knitting. And I mean, every one of his answers is this long arcing. He's been on the street for 35 years. He's done this a long time. He's seen it all, done it all, and he just is a great raconteur. So really interesting guy.
So this is
Tuesday, October 11th, New York Athletic Club.
What time?
Starts at 7 in the morning. It'll go at about 4. Okay. And I think we'll have some sort of a drinks and afterwards. We'll see what happens with that. If you go to Ritholtz.com or the Reform Broker or any of the other sites of people who are involved in it, Ritholtz.com.
Yeah, I'll have an ad on
so you'll click it. You'll see the full lineup. Should be I go to enough conferences. I know what I really don't like at these conferences.
Yes.
When we put this together, I wanted really interesting, really smart, really informative people able to discuss stuff that you probably haven't heard in a way that you probably never will again. And I'm really pleased with how the lineup came out. It looks like it's going to be a killer conference.
Well, I think it will, and I'm looking forward to it. And I also always look forward to talking to you on the podcast.
My pleasure.
You are one of the smartest people I know, and
well,
you're a great storyteller.
You're mistaken about that, but at least I have a lot of information I could spew
you're just
out.
Just bursting
right.
to share.
I just have a head full of this crap, and it's got to come out.
And I do really appreciate your time. And,
my pleasure.
Always fun.
Same here. Thanks, John.
That's it for this edition of the Housing Helix Podcast. As always, you can send comments and recommend guests to my email address, jmiller@millersamuel.com. This episode and the entire podcast library are available as a free subscription through iTunes and at thehousinghelix.com. So until next time, I'm Jonathan Miller, and thanks for listening to the Housing Helix Podcast.